American Free Press Audio Edition, Issue 5 and January 6, 2028 and February 4, 2019. Big Pharma's greed drug peddlers ring in 2019 with price increases, FinRails, by Dave Gallery. While the top 10 CEOs of some of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world have pay packages averaging $30 million a year, average Americans who depend on the products these masters of industry sell are dying to buy their drugs, literally, and this is not new to 2019. Ordinary Americans who can't afford the thousands of dollars it costs to stay alive have been dying for decades. As a direct result of the massive price increases Big Pharma has been getting away with since that time, take 26-year-old Alex Smith from Minnesota, a type 1 diabetic. Because of his condition, Smith was required to take insulin every day, which was not an issue when he was on his parents' health insurance. But when he turned 26, he was forced off their insurance policy and became responsible for the $1,300 a month it cost for him to stay alive. Unable to afford the insulin, Smith began rationing, which resulted in him falling into a diabetic coma. He died alone in his apartment. This tragedy is made much worse because the inventors of the 97-year-old medication, synthetic insulin, sold the patent for about $3 to get the drug to as many diabetics as possible. But drug makers have gotten around patent expirations like this by making small tweaks to their products, allowing them to keep patent protection ongoing for years, to the detriment of those whose lives depend on these medications. As an example, the price of insulin tripled from 2002 to 2013, with three of the top manufacturers hiking the price at least 10 times over the past decade. For the more than 1,000 drugs whose prices are being raised this year, the average increase will be around 6%. Incredibly, a much smaller percentage price hike than in previous years. In 2018, there were around 2,100 price increases with a median increase of 9%, compared to just under 1,400 hikes with a typical jump of 9.1% a year earlier, according to a stock market analyst, drug powerhouse Allergan, whose CEO Brenton L. Saunders brought home nearly $40 million last year, raised prices on over half its portfolio, 51 drugs, on January 1. Some 27 medications saw a 9.5% jump and the rest a 4.9% increase, reported CBS News. For Americans who have watched their real wages steadily decline for over three decades and have been forced to spend over half a trillion dollars on prescription medications in 2018, this is a most unwelcome trend. While straight-out price gouging is adding to the daily misery of millions of Americans, shortages and recalls are also leading drug makers to raise prices. The Wall Street Journal reported on January 18 that numerous drug manufacturers have sharply boosted prices of some older, low-cost prescription medicines amid supply shortages and recalls, in some cases, by threefold and more. The paper highlighted the popular blood pressure drug Valsartan, which has seen its price skyrocket since a series of safety-related recalls of the drug by other manufacturers began last summer. A Houston retiree who was paying $13 for a 90-day supply of the drug is now forced to pay over $100. Even worse, the muscle relaxant methocarbamol saw one supplier raise the price of a bottle from $8.49 to $105 due to an alleged supply shortage. Of the nearly 120 drugs listed by the Food and Drug Administration as currently or recently in shortage, reports the journal, about one-third had price increases after the shortages started. President Donald J. Trump has made reining in drug price increases a top priority, and his administration issued a 44-page plan last year on his vision for increasing competition, reducing regulations and changing incentives for players in the industry. APRESSONALMESSAGEFROMTHEEDITOR. Fake news, we haven't hit rock bottom yet? You'd think, by now, the mainstream media had hit rock bottom, but, nope, they just keep digging. And that's why American Free Press has decided to roll out a new feature we're calling This Week in Fake News. First came a report on January 17 from BuzzFeed Media that President Donald Trump had ordered his former attorney to perjure himself in front of Congress. According to the article, two unnamed law enforcement officials told BuzzFeed journalists that Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller's team was investigating the charge. CNN, The Washington Post, The New York Times, all the big media outlets jumped on the story with talk of impeaching the president, only to have cold water poured over the whole affair when, a day later, Mueller's own staff issued a rare public statement disputing the claim, saying BuzzFeed's description was not accurate. But all of that was quickly eclipsed by the fake news bonanza about an event that took place on the afternoon of January 18, at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. following the March for Life protest. This story played out on the internet and in the news throughout the weekend of Jan 1920, but we felt it was important enough to dedicate considerable editorial space for those who didn't get the true story. We're talking about the now infamous incident whereby a Native American protester by the name of Nathan Phillips was filmed face to face with a smiling 16-year-old boy, who had been waiting with a group of other boys for a bus to take them back home to Kentucky after a day of peaceful demonstration and sightseeing. By now, most people know how this bogus story blew up on an otherwise quiet Sunday morning. A snippet of a video was released that showed a group of young, mostly white boys being incredibly disrespectful to an old man. A still taken from that video showed one boy standing right in front of the old man, appearing to have a smirking smile on his face. The media and liberal activists on the internet were quick to pounce on this story because, simply put, it appeared to tick all of the boxes for them. They were all males in the group, check. They were all white except for one or two boys, check. They all went to a private Christian school and had been protesting abortion, check. But, worst of all, many of them appeared to be Trump supporters, who were wearing those red baseball hats that say, "Make America Great Again," check and check. Within hours on Sunday, January 20th, the boys had been condemned by media pundits, celebrities, and prominent left-wing and conservative activists. Their identities had been sourced. Their school had been contacted, their parents had received death threats, but then something happened. By Sunday night, new footage had emerged, including a two-hour-long video, which showed the boys had done nothing wrong at all. They were just standing there, having fun, while two groups of adults, the Native Americans and a bizarre group of black men who claimed to be the true descendants of the Israelites, were the bad actors. By Monday morning, a few brave souls in the mainstream media recognized their mistake and apologized, even going so far as to take down hateful screeds written about the boys. Still, though, amazingly, despite the overwhelming evidence that the boys did nothing wrong, despite the fact that it was revealed Phillips was the one who walked up to the group of boys and shouted "Go back to you, rip at them," despite the fact that the boys endured the black men calling them gay and racial slurs, the attacks on them in their community haven't stopped. In fact, as American Free Press went to press on January 24, they still hadn't stopped. The boys are still being threatened and called terrible names in the news and on social media. So here's the thing, the fact that overwhelming evidence shows the boys were innocent in all of this shows that this wasn't really ever about them. It has always been about a very vocal, powerful group of Americans, mostly on the left, who are so invested in their hatred of Trump that they were willing to publicly humiliate, threaten, and even advocate violence against American children, who had done nothing wrong other than appear to be supporters of the president. We're happy to say that we didn't fall for it, mostly because we're not caught up in this crazy cycle where, every day, people's emotions and outrage are farmed for advertising revenue. There's something to be said about putting out a bi-weekly newspaper where you actually have time to pause and think critically about the most important issues of the day. H. Christopher J. Petherick, Executive Editor, Life in the Marxist Age. Professor faces firing after spoof academic papers fool leftists. By Donald Jeffries, Portland State University Philosophy Professor Peter Boghossian recently attempted to expose how ludicrous political correctness has become. Unfortunately for him, his attempt succeeded all too well, and now he may be out of a job. Over the course of a few years, Boghossian and two academics produced 20 hoax essays, collectively called the Grievance Studies Experiment, that were written to be as ridiculous as possible and designed to appeal to small special interest groups made up of mostly far-left scholars. 7 of Boghossian's bogus studies were accepted for publication by social science journals, including a feminist rewrite of Hitler's Mein Kampf. The journal Gender, Place, and Culture bid on a piece claiming to study canine rape culture. In that study, Boghossian and his colleagues charge that dog parks are rape, condoning spaces in a place of rampant canine rape culture and systemic oppression against the oppressed dog through which human attitudes to both problems can be measured. Boghossian's team even claimed to have tactfully inspected the genitals of slightly fewer than 10,000 dogs whilst interrogating owners as to their sexuality. In another eagerly accepted article, the hoaxers demanded that the world of bodybuilding recognize fat bodybuilding as a fat, inclusive politicized performance. For his efforts, which once brought to light should have caused academia to engage in some self-analysis, Portland State University moved to fire Boghossian. I truly hope the administration puts its institutional weight behind the pursuit of truth, but I've been given no indication that's what they intend to do, Boghossian said. All of the journals involved are part of the dubious field of grievance studies. Some in the mainstream media attempted to rationalize and defend academia's attachment to the most extreme, and in these cases totally fabricated, areas of identity politics that focus on gender and race. A group of 11 Portland State professors and one graduate student published an anonymous letter in the student newspaper Vanguard, which featured a menacing image of Boghossian equipped with a Pinocchio nose. They charged Boghossian's team with repeated fraudulent behavior violating acceptable norms of research in any discipline and castigated the beleaguered professor for inviting James Damore, who was fired by Google for exercising his right to free speech, to an event at the university. Boghossian has not only indicated his less-than-collegial attitude through his hoaxes, they charged, but has actively targeted faculty at other institutions. None of us wish to contend with threats of death and assault from online trolls. Some in the academic world displayed a degree of rationality. Yasha Monk, a Harvard lecturer in government, condemned what he viewed as unfair attempts to undermine the hoaxers. Even if all of the charges laid at the feet of Boghossian and the two other authors were true, they would have demonstrated a very worrying fact, Monk wrote. Some of the leading journals in areas like gender studies have failed to distinguish between real scholarship and intellectually vacuous as well as morally troubling, expletive deleted. In a recent YouTube video, Boghossian read an email from Portland State, which threatened an investigation and sanctions against him. I think that they will do everything and anything in their power to get me out, he stated. And I think this is the first shot in that. Boghossian's case is merely the latest example of political correctness run amok on college campuses across the country. Earlier this month, it was widely reported that Washington, D.C.'s American University would be hosting a multi-session seminar aimed at getting faculty to combat white language supremacy. The seminar will also propose alternative methods of assessing writing other than quality, such as labor-based grading contracts. While even the most unthreatening and lukewarm conservative voices have been denied the opportunity to speak at various universities, some astonishingly anti-white figures have been welcomed. Christian Evangelical Wheaton College, not a typical leftist institution, permitted Emory University philosophy professor George Yancey to speak there in 2017, in the esteemed Billy Graham Center on campus. His speech was filled with expletives and hateful declarations like, "To be white is to be racist." Stevens College, a women's college in Columbia, MU, recently announced that it will admit and enroll students who were not born female, but who identify and live as women. A women Mount Holyoke College canceled plans to change its logo to add a protest that it could be perceived as not being inclusive to transgender students. Boghossian merely demonstrated what is obvious. In today's America, satire is impossible while a frighteningly authoritarian political correctness rules the day. Christian kids victimized, vilified leftist print electronic media smear Catholic students with fake news report by John Friend fresh on the heels of a far-left media company claiming erroneously that President Donald Trump had told his former attorney to lie to Congress. A storm of fake news circulated the third weekend in January purporting to show a group of entitled pro-Trump boys disrespecting an elderly Native American, The story had all of the hallmarks of the phony modern narrative the anti-Trump media loves to promote. Here was a group of young, mostly white males supposedly shouting, "Build the wall," and mocking a minority group, in this case, Native Americans, one of whom falsely claimed to be a Vietnam veteran. Partial video footage of the encounter, which supposedly proved the report's veracity, went viral on social media and was picked up by countless mainstream media outlets in a blatantly dishonest attempt to portray the high school students, who had just participated in a pro-life rally in the nation's capital earlier the day, as entitled, "Disrespectful, Hateful Bigots." It turns out, that is not at all what happened. In the age of cell phones, individuals who were on the scene at the time posted video to the internet that showed that none of what the media and far-left activists online were claiming actually happened. So what really took place? At 4:30 p.m. on January 18, a group of mostly white high school students from Covington Catholic High School in Kentucky, many of whom were wearing President Donald Trump's iconic red "Make America Great Again, MAGA," hat, arrived at the Lincoln Memorial with adult chaperones to wait for their bus to travel back to Kentucky. Upon arriving at the memorial, four protesters from a crazy group that calls itself the Black Hebrew Israelites began engaging the boys, taunting them and calling them vulgar, hateful names. In response, the students began chanting school spirit songs that are normally reserved for high school football and basketball games. Soon thereafter, a group of Native American protesters, who were also at the memorial for an event, confronted the students and began chanting and playing a drum. The partial video footage initially picked up by the fake news media only shows the students chanting at the Native American protesters, giving the false impression that the high school students confronted and surrounded the Native Americans. Media narratives emerged contending that the students were disrespectful, racist, and bigoted, when in reality they were simply waiting for their bus to arrive and were themselves confronted by both the Black Hebrew Israelite protesters and the Native American protesters. It was made worse by the fact that the elderly Native American man in the picture, Nathan Phillips, told media outlets that the children were shouting "Build the wall" at him during the encounter, a claim that has been disproven by video that shows the entire encounter from start to finish. Phillips is a member of the American Indian Movement, or AIM, which has a long history of provocations, including a now infamous incident at an Indian reservation in South Dakota that resulted in the deaths of two federal law enforcement agents. Left-leaning activists and personalities were outraged at the footage, with many prominent figures calling for the students to be doxxed, having their personal information exposed online in an attempt to defame, slander, and harass the students, while others called for violence. The reply from the school was pathetic and impotent. Kathy Griffin, a radical left-wing, anti-Trump actress, tweeted following the incident, "Name these kids, I want names, shame them." Jack Morrissey, a well-known Disney film producer, posted an image on Twitter of a fictional person being shoved into a wood chipper with fake blood spewing from the machine with the caption, "MAGA kids go screaming, hats first, into the wood chipper." The tweet has since been deleted, but not before it caught the attention of numerous journalists and social media users. It was so bad that some of the students' names and home addresses were uncovered by liberal activists. Nick Sandman, the boy who can be seen awkwardly smiling at Phillips in the commonly posted video of the incident, has received death threats and other forms of harassment and ridicule following this dishonest media reporting. Following the publication of more detailed and objective analyses of the encounter, which gave a fuller picture of what really transpired, a number of journalists and pundits have had to apologize for the rush to judgment of the high school students. Nick Sandman issued a public statement describing his experience at the memorial and what has transpired in the aftermath. You can read Sandman's statement on pages 8-9 in this issue. President Trump has offered support for the students, tweeting that the students were treated unfairly with early judgments proving out to be false, smeared by media. In a separate tweet, the president lambasted the fake news media for disseminating the highly distorted and dishonest narrative that initially emerged. Nick Sandman and the students of Covington have become symbols of fake news and how evil it can be, Trump tweeted. They have captivated the attention of the world, and I know they will use it for the good, maybe even to bring people together. Fake news blows up in media's face. 16-year-old student school's media activist after being smeared by hate mongers. The following statement was written by Nick Sandman, the Covington Catholic High School junior who was attacked and smeared in the mainstream media and on the internet on January 20 when far-left activists, celebrities, and national media outlets parroted totally false information concerning a protest. Sandman and his fellow classmates found themselves in near the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. I am providing this factual account of what happened on Friday afternoon at the Lincoln Memorial to correct misinformation and outright lies being spread about my family and me. I am the student in the video who was confronted by the Native American protester. I arrived at the Lincoln Memorial at 4:30 p.m. I was told to be there by 5:30 p.m., when our buses were due to leave Washington for the trip back to Kentucky. We had been attending the March for Life rally, and then had split up into small groups to do sightseeing. When we arrived, we noticed four African American protesters who were also on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. I am not sure what they were protesting, and I did not interact with them. I did hear them direct derogatory insults at our school group. The protesters said hateful things. They called us racists, bigots, white crackers, faggots, and incest kids. They also taunted an African American student from my school by telling him that we would harvest his organs. I have no idea what that insult means, but it was startling to hear, because we were being loudly attacked and taunted in public. A student in our group asked one of our teacher chaperones for permission to begin our school spirit chants to counter the hateful things that were being shouted at our group. The chants are commonly used at sporting events. They are all positive in nature and sound like what you would hear at any high school. Our chaperone gave us permission to use our school chants. We would not have done that without obtaining permission from the adults in charge of our group. At no time did I hear any student chant anything other than the school spirit chants. I did not witness or hear any students chant build a wall or anything hateful or racist at any time. Assertions to the contrary are simply false. Our chants were loud because we wanted to drown out the hateful comments that were being shouted at us by the protesters. After a few minutes of chanting, the Native American protesters, who I hadn't previously noticed, approached our group. The Native American protesters had drums and were accompanied by at least one person with a camera. The protester everyone has seen in the video began playing his drum as he waded into the crowd, which parted for him. I did not see anyone try to block his path. He locked eyes with me and approached me, coming within inches of my face. He played his drum the entire time he was in my face. I never interacted with this protester. I did not speak to him. I did not make any hand gestures or other aggressive moves. To be honest, I was startled and confused as to why he had approached me. We had already been yelled at by another group of protesters, and when the second group approached, I was worried that a situation was getting out of control where adults were attempting to provoke teenagers. I believed that by remaining motionless and calm, I was helping to defuse the situation. I realized everyone had cameras and that perhaps a group of adults was trying to provoke a group of teenagers into a larger conflict. I said a silent prayer that the situation would not get out of hand. During the period of the drumming, a member of the protesters' entourage began yelling at a fellow student that we stole Indian land and that we should go back to Europe. I heard one of my fellow students begin to respond. I motioned to my classmate and tried to get him to stop engaging with the protester, as I was still in the mindset that we needed to calm down tensions. I never felt like I was blocking the Native American protester. He did not make any attempt to go around me. It was clear to me that he'd singled me out for a confrontation, although I'm not sure why. The engagement ended when one of our teachers told me the buses had arrived and it was time to go. I obeyed my teacher and simply walked to the buses. At that moment, I thought I had defused the situation by remaining calm, and I was thankful nothing physical had occurred. I never understood why either of the two groups of protesters were engaging with us, or exactly what they were protesting at the Lincoln Memorial. We were simply there to meet a bus, not become central players in a media spectacle. This is the first time in my life I've ever encountered any sort of public protest. let alone this kind of confrontation or demonstration. I was not intentionally making faces at the protester. I did smile at one point because I wanted him to know that I was not going to become angry, intimidated or be provoked into a larger confrontation. I am a faithful Christian and practicing Catholic, and I always try to live up to the ideals my faith teaches me, to remain respectful of others and to take no action that would lead to conflict or violence. I harbor no ill will for this person. I respect this person's right to protest and engage in free speech activities, and I support his chanting on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial any day of the week. I believe he should rethink his tactics of invading the personal space of others, but that is his choice to make. I am being called every name in the book, including a racist, and I will not stand for this mob-like character assassination of my family's name. My parents were not on the trip, and I strive to represent my family in a respectful way in all public settings. I have received physical and death threats via social media, as well as hateful insults. One person threatened to harm me at school, and one person claims to live in my neighborhood. My parents are receiving death and professional threats because of the social media mob that has formed over this issue. I love my school, my teachers and my classmates. I work hard to achieve good grades and to participate in several extracurricular activities. I am mortified that so many people have come to believe something that did not happen, that students from my school were chanting or acting in a racist fashion toward African Americans or Native Americans. I did not do that, did not have hateful feelings in my heart, and did not witness any of my classmates doing that. I cannot speak for everyone, only for myself. But I can tell you my experience with Covington Catholic is that students are respectful of all races and cultures. We also support everyone's right to free speech. I am not going to comment on the words or account of Mr. Phillips, as I don't know him and would not presume to know what is in his heart or mind. Nor am I going to comment further on the other protesters, as I don't know their hearts or minds, either. I have read that Mr. Phillips is a veteran of the United States Marines. I thank him for his service and am grateful to anyone who puts on the uniform to defend our nation. If anyone has earned the right to speak freely, it is a U.S. Marine veteran. I can only speak for myself and what I observed and felt at the time, but I would question everyone passing judgment based on a few seconds of video to watch the longer video clips that are on the internet, as they show a much different story than is being portrayed by people with agendas. I provided this account of events to the Diocese of Covington so they may know exactly what happened, and I stand ready and willing to cooperate with any investigation they are conducting. GOP strips young activist of position for racism, by John Friend James Alsup, a young, conservative, independent journalist and rising YouTube star, was stripped of his elected position as a local precinct committee officer, PCO, for the Whitman County Republican Party in rural eastern Washington. It was recently reported, Alsup had been legitimately elected as a PCO in Whitman County in the summer of 2018. PCOs are members of the overall county central committee of their respected party and help organize events and activities as well as represent the party at the local level. While attending college at Washington State University in nearby Pullman, Wash, Alsup was president of the College Republican Club on campus and was heavily involved with the local Republican Party throughout the heated 2016 election season. He helped organize events both in the community and on campus, recruited other Republicans, and encouraged voters to support Republican candidates in the election. Alsup also launched a YouTube channel, began hosting and participating in various radio programs, and eventually became a leading figure among young conservatives. After his participation in the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Vol. In the summer of 2017, radical left-wing media outlets and activists began targeting Alsup in an attempt to demonize and discredit the young activist and political organizer whose political views were becoming more and more widely known. Following his successful election in the summer of 2018 as a PCO for the local GOP, a number of malicious articles appeared in the left-wing media, including a hysterical piece published by the Daily Beast entitled, Charlottesville Hate March Re-Elected by Republican Party, the Republican National Committee, RNC, immediately denounced Alsop after news of his election spread. "We condemn this individual and his hateful, racist views in the strongest possible terms," an RNC spokesperson was quoted as stating in the Daily Beast article. "There's no place for it in the Republican Party." The Washington State Republican Party likewise denounced Alsop and his views, telling the Daily Beast, "We condemn this hateful ideology before, we condemn it today, and will continue to condemn it in the future." Republican Rep. Kathy McMorris Rogers, whose district Alsop lived in, also attacked the young Republican activist, saying she was disappointed that Alsop was being allowed to represent the party following his successful election. Rep. Rogers also claimed Alsop promoted white supremacy, racism, and bigotry, and that our communities must not include space for individuals who promote, condone, or participate in racism and violence, an arguably libelous accusation against Alsop. Now the Whitman County Republican Central Committee has voted unanimously to essentially expel Alsop from the local party, despite his legal status as an elected official with the party. On January 5, the committee met and voted overwhelmingly to unseat Alsop from his position, meaning he has no vote on the committee and is not recognized by the party, although he continues to technically retain the position as a PCO due to his successful election. In a YouTube video made in response to his expulsion from the local GOP, Alsop criticized the Whitman County Republican leadership as spineless and cowardly for being intimidated by the media and outside pressure groups. "It's disappointing to see spineless Republicans cower in fear of leftists all because they're afraid of mean comments from the journalists that hate them anyway," Alsop stated in response. By his own account, Alsop was one of the most energetic and effective GOP activists in the area and had been for years, yet his expulsion from the party did not surprise him, considering the pathetic state of the mainstream Republican Party and its leadership. "Of course, as you well know, I have never advocated for any sort of racial supremacy, not here, not on podcasts, not anywhere," Alsop stated in a recent YouTube video. "Many people, who claim to be conservatives, are so cowardly, they would rather go along with the left and the media and falsely call someone a racial supremacist, even if it's someone on their own side of most issues and even if there is no evidence for the claim. That's what we saw here." Despite being ejected by the local party, Alsop remains optimistic about the future of the GOP and encourages other young activists to get involved in politics. "The fact that I was able to run for office as a PCO, and win, should be seen as excellent news," Alsop recently wrote on Facebook. "Young people are the future of the party and the nation. It's time to get involved, and I encourage all of you to follow my example, win your local elections, and begin solidifying our political base for years to come." Congressman vilified for comments, mainstream media cry racism, excoriate Rep. Steve King over trivial statements. By Dr. Kevin Barrett. Let me preface what I am about to say by disavowing all forms of racism and hatred. I am classified as white according to the simplistic ethnic identity system that prevails in the United States, but the last I checked that wasn't a crime, just a cause for guilt, hand-wringing, and hypocrisy. I am pretty sure I'm not particularly racist. I spent many years living in mostly black neighborhoods in the San Francisco Bay Area and loved it. I was happy when a close high school friend married an African American woman, not because she was black, but because she was gorgeous, friendly, and down to earth. My own wife is an American who immigrated from Morocco, and whose ancestry stems from much of Europe, Asia, and Africa. I have no personal interest in preserving the purity of any race. My race is the human race. That said, I am not about to join the lynch mob hounding Rep. Steve King, D'Iowa, who represents a district about an hour's drive from my house. The New York Times is hounding King over his history of racist remarks. House Republicans have obediently removed King from his committee assignments and may join Democrats in formally censuring him. Yet, by any sane measure, most of King's supposedly racist statements are monumentally less offensive than what the whole U.S. government has been doing to black, brown, and yellow people since World War II, massacring them in ongoing military and CIA interventions that scholar and author William Bloom has called the American Holocaust. whose total number of victims is reliably estimated to be around 60 million, as tallied in a book by Noam Chomsky and Andrei Vlachek titled On Western Terrorism, compared to the ongoing American Holocaust of 60 million non-white people. The supposed speech crimes of King are pretty mild. Consider the first racist remark on King's Times rap sheet. King introduced a bill, stating that the USA is the unchallenged greatest nation in the world and that it has derived its strength from Christianity, free enterprise capitalism, and Western civilization. That statement may be banal, it may be parochial, it may overestimate free enterprise capitalism, which has metastasized into today's global neoliberal cancer, but racist. The Times continues listing King's speech crimes. Mr. King is the chief sponsor of a law making English the official language of Iowa, then introduces the English Language Unity Act, a bill to make English the official language of the United States. Mr. King sues the Iowa Secretary of State for posting voting information on an official website in Spanish, Laotian, Bosnian, and Vietnamese. Okay, so the guy isn't so good with foreign languages, like most Americans. But what does any of this have to do with racism? Aren't the real racists those people who believe that today's mostly non-white immigrants, unlike the mostly white immigrants of yesteryear, are too stupid to learn English, like President Donald Trump? King has made ill-informed remarks exaggerating the crime threat posed by illegal immigrants. Some of these statements could conceivably be called racist in that they unfairly and inaccurately denigrate an ethnic group, Hispanics, so I won't defend those, but the majority of King's supposed speech crimes are either positive statements about his own groups, whites, Western civilization, Americans, or reasonable expressions of concern about those groups' demographic decline. The Times thinks King is a racist for saying, "Preventing babies being born is not medicine. That's not constructive to our culture and our civilization. If we let our birth rate get down below the replacement rate, we're a dying civilization." That statement obviously is not racist. What's more, it is largely accurate. So why is it such a problem? By addressing the issue of the demographic decline of white Americans, and people of European ancestry in general, King is touching on realities that are currently unspeakable in mainstream discourse. But when America's liberal gatekeepers clamp a tight lid on this subject, they simply increase the pressure inside the pressure cooker, increasing the likelihood of an eventual explosion. When colonial France sent more than a million white French settlers into Algeria, the native Algerians understandably rebelled. The result was a horrific war. When European Jews flooded into Palestine against the wishes of the Palestinian people, the Palestinians understandably rebelled. The result is endless regional war, a war that has taken more than 10 million lives and is far from over. It is normal for people to defend their own ethnicity and its claim on territory occupied for generations. White Americans, scheduled for minority status by 2050, are increasingly unhappy with that prospect. And why shouldn't they be? This taboo topic calls for thoughtful conversation, not shaming and silencing. Gillette feels backlash after running male bashing ad by Donald Jeffries. A new ad promoting Gillette razors exemplifies the radical left social justice mindset that has taken a firm hold on American culture. As is typical of commercials these days, the white males are portrayed negatively, with women and non-white males attempting to free them from their astounding incompetence and bad behavior. The Gillette ad comes complete with a suitable title, Believe, clearly referencing the Me Too movement. The company has declared that men must hold each other accountable. The commercial was watched an incredible 2 million plus times in the first 48 hours, and the response was decidedly negative, receiving only 23,000 likes and 214,000 dislikes. In one scene, an absurdly over-the-top, lecherous white male with a snidely whiplash look on his face is reaching out to grab the backside of an African-American maid. The faces of male reason in the ad were all black, attempting to hold back their misogynistic, bullying white counterparts. Irate viewers commented that the ad was feminist propaganda, and one wrote, "In less than 2 minutes you managed to alienate your biggest sales group." Boycott Gillette was quickly trending on Twitter, with untold numbers of former Gillette customers swearing off the brand's products forever. So far, Gillette, which is owned by Procter & Gamble, is refusing to apologize or back down, Gillette President Gary Coombs stated. Effective immediately, Gillette will review all public-facing content against a set of defined standards meant to ensure we fully reflect the ideals of respect, accountability and role modeling in the ads we run, the images we publish to social media, the words we choose, and more. In today's corporate world, there are obviously agendas beyond profits. The Gillette commercial is bad enough by itself, but, in today's culture of political correctness run amok, the trouble keeps piling on. In early January, the American Psychological Association, one of the governing bodies for U.S. psychologists, issued new guidelines for clinicians working with boys and men that suggest traditional masculinity is psychologically harmful, a pathology that should be discouraged in men and boys. Ryan McDermott, a psychologist at the University of South Alabama, who helped draft the guidelines, stated, "What is gender in the 2000s? It's no longer just this male-female binary. If we can change men, we can change the world. So what kinds of masculine traits do these radical activists say are bad?" Bizarrely, they claim that even a male characteristic like competitiveness leads to bad behavior and is something that should be discouraged, especially among boys. You would never know that maleness was ever synonymous with anything good. Reading this report, said American Enterprise Institute scholar and former ethics philosopher Christina Hoff Sommers, author of Who Stole Feminism? And The War Against Boys, among other titles, and co-host of the popular Femsplainers podcast. Today, American television viewers are all too familiar with the goofy, clueless father, especially white fathers, whose wife utterly dominates him and whose children have zero respect for him. This week, worthless stereotypical figure has supplanted the strong, dominant fathers in sitcoms decades ago. In programs like Father Knows Best and Leave It to Beaver, today's commercials are even more poisonously anti-male. They all seem to meld into one. The white male, in particular, is dumpy and woefully ignorant with a face that cries out to be dominated. The woman is bright, competent, and very, very aggressive. The white male's children roll their eyes in exasperation at him and can fool him without the slightest effort. In a 2018 essay in the New York Times, Michael Ian Black wrote, "The past 50 years have redefined what it means to be female in America. Girls today are told that they can do anything, be anyone. They've absorbed the message. They're outperforming boys in school at every level. But it isn't just about performance. To be a girl today is to be the beneficiary of decades of conversation about the complexities of womanhood, its many forms and expressions. Boys, though, have been left behind. No commensurate movement has emerged to help them navigate toward a full expression of their gender. It's no longer enough to be a man. We no longer even know what that means. It doesn't take a sociologist to understand how damaging all of this can be to boys today." Is it any wonder that suicide among white males has skyrocketed in the past few years? Parkland shooting report released commission recommends arming school teachers, new police procedures. By St. Patrick on Valentine's Day in 2018, a gunman opened fire at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, MSD, High School in Parkland, Florida. 17 students and staff members were killed, while 17 others were injured. Nearly 1 year later, the MSD commission investigating the case has made its final recommendations. The commission's suggestions may be more controversial than the theories surrounding the original case. The section immediately highlighted and criticized by the local media was the recommendation that Florida educators who volunteer and undergo training be allowed to carry firearms in schools. The teachers' union, relatively weak in Florida, a right-to-work state, and the state PTA both opposed the recommendation of the 446-page report that was unanimously approved by the commission. The report, however, is not law. The Florida state legislature would have to approve the proposals before they could be enacted by the state's 67 countywide school districts. Every private school, religious and secular, would then have to create their own separate guidelines, as private entities can still legally ban guns on private property. The more notable areas of the report deal with criticisms of the Broward County Sheriff's Office, whose active shooter policy is said to have contributed to the chaos of the event. The ambiguous policy of Sheriff Scott Israel read that deputies may rather than shall or will confront an active shooter. This gave several deputies a reason to not enter the building to subdue any threat that may have existed. Even Deputy Scott Peterson, who was assigned as the school's on-site resource deputy, chose to remain outside. While Israel expressed his disappointment regarding the inaction of Peterson, he justified the previous policy by saying that he didn't want law enforcement to engage in suicide missions. Polk County Sheriff Grady Judd, an MSD commissioner, described the generally worded active shooter policy May gave them, deputies, the out not to enter, said Sheriff Judd. They decided to be cowards instead of heroes. Broward County has recently changed its active shooter policy, indirectly accepting some responsibility for the failures of law enforcement. The policy now reads shall instead of may, which, according to the commission, is more consistent with standard law enforcement procedures. Other suggestions were contained within the report, that law enforcement officers assigned to public schools undergo annual active shooter training, which would include situations when they are alone, that neighboring local police forces have radios that can easily communicate between cities, that Florida school districts allow law enforcement real-time access to their internal video surveillance systems, and that schools have single, monitored, staffed points of entry and exit. There was much discussion about safety within classrooms themselves. The recommendations were that all classrooms have automatically locking doors, windows that can be quickly covered, entryway intercoms that can be easily accessed in case of emergency. Modern classrooms regularly have school-wide email or messaging systems, but few schools in the age of technology have improved and modernized their intercom systems. Still perplexing are the mandatory emergency drills conducted by schools every year. Since many school shooters are students who actually attend the school, the mandatory drills do little but to inform the future school shooters of the procedures that will be taken when he or she engages in the act. The mandatory safety drills then become an informational part of the shooter's planning. Parkland remains a lightning rod within the alternative political analysis communities. While it appears that a majority of observers do believe that MSDHS was the site of a tragic Valentine's Day massacre in 2018, there are still some, such as editor Jim Fetzer, the Parkland Puzzle, and commentator Ole Damigert, who believe that it was a false flag operation used to heighten the police state and strengthen the anti-gun movement. The chaos of the day and the ineffective nature of law enforcement behaviors only add to myriad questions that are still asked. How to start a world war provoking an incident or a false flag? The best way to keep U.S. and Middle East forever. By Phil Giraldi. The White House decision to withdraw American troops from Syria as soon as possible may or may not be on track depending on whom one believes, but one thing that is for sure is that the recent suicide bomber attack in Manbij, Syria, which killed four Americans and has been attributed to ISIS, has inspired the opponents of the drawdown to renew their claim that the terrorist group is still an active threat to the United States. President Donald Trump is now being subjected to heavy bipartisan and media pressure to reverse his decision. It is perhaps a coincidence that the attack should take place not long after the White House announcement of the withdrawal, thereby giving ammunition to those who wish to stay in Syria, admittedly illegally, for the foreseeable future. Or is it perhaps something else? Why, one must ask, did ISIS do something against its own interest by attacking Americans and thereby increasing the odds that U.S. armed forces would remain in Syria? Wouldn't it have been preferable to just let the American military leave, thereby eliminating one enemy from the playing field? Former Arms Inspector Scott Ritter, in a detailed analysis of what is going on in Syria, has asked those questions and comes up with an explanation. Far from being an enemy of ISIS, the U.S. has actually served to protect the group. American presence in northeast Syria, where the ISIS remnants are still holding on, has actually prevented the final destruction of the terrorist group. Without the U.S. serving as an impediment, the armed forces of Syria aided by Russia and Iran would have already crushed ISIS in its remaining enclaves. Thus it is, against all conventional wisdom, the United States that is serving as ISIS's protector. And the group staged the bombing deliberately with that in mind because it is better from their viewpoint to have American forces remain. They also clearly understood enough about American politics and its media to realize that they would be giving fuel to those in Congress and among the mainstream punditry to put more pressure on Trump to have the troops remain in place. That is how you start a war, or at least keep one going. It is called deception, or, when carried out by a state actor, a false flag in that the event is capable of being misinterpreted or misattributed to produce a desired result. There have been numerous deception operations throughout history used to start wars. The battleship Maine was not blown up by the Spaniards in Havana Harbor in 1898, but it served as a useful pretext to start a war that stripped Spain of its colonies. The Zimmerman telegram in World War I was a phony, but it helped bring the U.S. into the war against Germany. More recently, there were the two Gulf of Tonkin incidents, both lies, which dramatically increased American involvement in Vietnam, and one should not forget the largely fabricated humanitarian and national security arguments made to attack Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya. If one goes by the message coming out of the White House and State Department, it would appear that the next country being targeted by the U.S. for regime change is Iran, and the best way to start the war would be to have the Iranians, or someone pretending to be the Iranians, attack a U.S. naval vessel in the Persian Gulf. If it were carried out by, let us suggest, the Israelis or Saudis, both of whom have motive to do so, it would be a false flag operation leading to war. It would also be a false flag if the U.S. itself were to carry out the attack pretending to be Iranians. One recalls from the movie Patton the general's hatred of the Russians and his rant at the end of the film, "In 10 days I'll have us at war with those sons of B and I'll make it look like their fault." There are, unfortunately, many in D.C. who would support such an approach, including Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and National Security Advisor John Bolton. Some observers are concerned that the current lineup of administration hotheads is so devoid of scruples that it might well be planning to either provoke or false flag the United States into the longed-for war against Iran. Unfortunately, to a certain extent, Iran is playing into the scheming by America's hawks. Early in December, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani threatened to stop all shipping passing through the Strait of Hormuz if Washington moves to block Iranian oil exports when sanctions kick in early in May. He said, "If someday, the United States decides to block Iran's oil, no oil will be exported from the Persian Gulf." Washington for its part is also upping the ante, having sent an aircraft carrier, the USS John C. Stennis, to the Persian Gulf recently as part of a show of force. Iran has also beefed up its forces by deploying a considerable naval force to the Indian Ocean near the Persian Gulf, ready to move into the strait and close it if ordered to do so. Iran claims that it completely controls the strait, as nearly 30% of all seaborne oil passes through the Strait of Hormuz with the Stennis and Iranian forces on standby in the same area. The possibility of a fight starting either deliberately or by accident is growing. In early December, State Department Special Representative on Iran Brian Hook declared during a press conference that Washington would not hesitate to use military force when our interests are threatened. The military option on the table, one does not have to suggest that either the United States or one of its alleged allies in the Middle East will inevitably take the low road and stage an incident, but the possibility remains it will occur to someone that this would be the easiest path to war. Others, who want war but are more cautious in terms of how they will initiate it, are probably waiting for the May 5th deadline when the U.S. embargo on Iranian oil sales kicks in. Iran will be forced to react, and the U.S. is no doubt preparing to strike back. We will thereby have a new war that serves no one's interest apart from Israel and the Saudis, and which will potentially devastate the region. The American people will have to do the actual fighting and dying while also paying the bills afterwards, and will emerge as the biggest losers. Capital H, Israel running risks in trying to exploit U.S. exit from Syria, by Richard Walker. In an effort to exploit the planned exit of U.S. special forces and mercenaries from Syria, Israeli officials are promising to continue bombing the country in violation of international law. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was quoted as saying it would be business as usual, but he might want to consider the fact that Russia will not allow him free rein to bomb Syria as he likes. Russian President Vladimir Putin has made it clear to him that there are some lines he should not cross. One is killing or targeting Russian military personnel in Syria. Another is Russian personnel becoming collateral damage of Israeli attacks on other targets. In the past 3 years, Israel has bombed Syria several hundred times in a clear breach of international law. It claims that its bombing of a sovereign state is justified by its need for defense. Of course, this is a false legal argument. UN Charter 51 states specifically that a UN mandate is required by any country wishing to launch a war against another. And if self-defense is used as justification, the country launching a war must have been attacked. Syria has never attacked Israel, but as with so much of Israel's foreign policy, it has been willing to flout international law, because Israelis know there will be no repercussions for its lawlessness. There are few countries in the region that have not been the target of Israel's air force or of its assassination squads. President Donald Trump's decision to fulfill his electoral promise to take troops out of Syria has angered Israel because it has consistently used U.S. involvement in the Syrian conflict as a cover for launching hundreds of air and ground strikes into Syria and Lebanon. With the White House announcement of the pullout, Netanyahu and members of his hard-right cabinet announced that attacks on Syria would continue unabated and might be increased. Israel's strategy has been to exploit the Syrian conflict to target Iranian military advisors and Iranian-backed militias who have been fighting ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and the al-Nusra Front alongside Syrian and Russian military forces. In contrast, ISIS has never been Israel's priority. In fact, Israel has armed, trained, and provided medical care to al-Nusra fighters. It has been focused on killing Iranians, hoping to goad Iran and Hezbollah into a full-blown conflict that would draw in the U.S. military and Netanyahu's new allies, the Saudis. In that respect, Netanyahu likely has a backer in National Security Advisor John Bolton, who has made it clear he would like to bomb Iran. Netanyahu, nevertheless, has been accused by Israelis of bombing Syria and hyping an Iran threat from there to deflect from corruption charges he faces at home as new elections get closer. With a U.S. pullout, Israeli military planners are facing a new and potentially deadly issue, namely the continued presence of Russian forces and their S-400 missile batteries. Those, and the S-300 batteries Moscow gave the Syrian government, have already had a limiting effect on Israeli air incursions into Syrian airspace. Russia's military has warned Israel that there will be serious consequences if it targets Russian forces or if Russian military personnel are casualties of an attack on Syria or Iranian targets. There is no love lost between Putin and Netanyahu following the shooting down of an Ilyushin Il-20M Russian surveillance plane over Syria in 2018. The downing of the plane resulted in the deaths of 15 Russian personnel on board. The propeller plane, a flying command post, was shot down by missiles fired from older Russian S-200 anti-aircraft batteries operated at the time by the Syrian military. Russian military investigators, however, quickly determined that blame lay with Israel. According to Russian experts, two of four Israeli jets that entered Syria to carry out attacks used the cover of the larger Il-20M. An S-200 missile fired at the jets locked instead on the larger Russian plane. Israel, as it always does, blamed the Syrian military, but operators of highly advanced S-400 batteries protecting the Russian Khmeim Air Base in Syria had recorded everything. According to reports, Putin was so angry with Netanyahu's and Israel's denials that he immediately upgraded Syria's S-200 batteries to the S-300. The U.S. exodus will reduce American military traffic in the region, allowing Russian and Syrian missile operators to concentrate on all Israeli military fighter aircraft exiting Israel en route to Syria. Gideon Levy, a leading columnist with Haaretz, one of Israel's prominent news outlets, was alarmed after the downing of the Russian plane. He warned Israel that its actions in Syria were reckless and would come with a price. His views were not given an airing by the U.S. mainstream media, more than likely because they were highly critical of Israel's Syria interventions. With a U.S. withdrawal, Netanyahu's tendency to recklessness could well lead to a confrontation with Russia over the skies of the Middle East. Reopened JFK, MLK, RFK investigations by S.T. Patrick on the eve of Martin Luther King Jr.'s national holiday. 66 researchers, authors, celebrities, witnesses, and talk show hosts are calling for a Congressional Truth and Reconciliation Committee to reinvestigate the murders of John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., and Malcolm X. While the initial press release called each signee a prominent citizen, the names that will surely carry the most weight with Congress and with average Americans are those with personal ties to the former dirt leaders. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the author of American Values, raised significant questions in his recently released book. His sister, Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, also signed the call to action and the joint statement on the Kennedy, King, and Malcolm X assassinations and ongoing cover-ups. The Kennedy family is new to public skepticism. There has long been an establishment defense that any further investigation would be hurtful to the Kennedy family. What we have learned in the past decade is that the Kennedy family, itself, has been skeptical since JFK was murdered and Alice on November 22, 1963. In Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, journalist David Talbot explained that Robert Kennedy had always believed his brother's assassination was the result of a conspiracy. When RFK was killed in Los Angeles on June 6, 1968, the possibility of reopening the JFK assassination case in the 60s ended. While John Kennedy Jr. and Caroline Kennedy were silent on the topic of assassination while their mother Jacqueline was alive, it has been rumored that John Jr., as the co-founder of George Magazine, was about to launch a full investigation of his father's murder when he was killed in a plane crash on July 16, 1999. The King family has for decades been more supportive of a reinvestigation. King's son Dexter has been an ardent proponent of reopening the case, as RFK Jr. has recently met with an imprisoned Sirhan Sirhan. Dexter King met with the imprisoned James Earl Ray in 1997. Ray denied killing MLK, and King's son told Ray that he and the rest of the family believe him. Some members of the King family have been against reopening the case, though still believing in conspiracy, as they find it damaging to further publicize MLK's personal affairs. MLK's nephew, Isaac Newton Ferris Jr., and his longtime collaborator in nonviolence, Reverend James M. Lawson Jr., are two of the 66 signees. William Pepper, the attorney for Ray and the chief author of the MLK case, is also listed. The murder of Malcolm X is the least discussed and written about of the four, but it is not of less importance. Whenever intelligence agencies, domestic or international, have a hand in the murder of a public figure, it is important to find the truth. Rodnell Collins, a first cousin of Malcolm X and the curator of Malcolm's childhood home, joins Carl Evans, author of The Judas Factor, The Plot to Kill Malcolm X, on the list of signees calling for action. The celebrities involved include director Oliver Stone, director Rob Reiner, actor Alec Baldwin, musician David Crosby, humorist Mort Saul, and actor Martin Sheen. Radical New Democrats, big spenders, newly elected socialist communist politicians want you to open your purses wide. By St. Patrick, the mainstream media have spent months lauding the influx of radical New Democrats that walk the halls of Capitol Hill since winning the 2018 midterm elections. While their ideas can seem dangerously far left, they are not new. They are also not a result of an isolated movement contained within the Democratic Party itself. The most prominent media darling of the new crop has been 29-year-old Rep. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, DNY, who has announced that she will favor enacting a Green New Deal. The goal of the plan would be to end nearly all fossil fuel use by 2030. The plan is largely economic, but it also details environmental regulations and changes that would require expensive upgrades to every home and business. In hindsight, leading Democrat analysts have decried Obamacare, explaining the failure was that it didn't reach far enough. The Green New Deal calls openly for a single-payer healthcare system, as an attempt to solve the economic inequity that exists between the top and the bottom. Ocasio-Cortez is calling for a basic income program, as well as a federal jobs guarantee, which seeks to bring the unemployment rate to zero by using the government as the employer of last resort, ELR. The Green New Deal is not the brainchild of one of the first millennials elected to Congress. It has its origin, at least in part, In the Canadian Leap Manifesto that socialist candidates have been endorsing there for over a decade, the Leap Manifesto called for a 100% dependency on green energy by 2050, a massive government program to retrofit housing, and a universal basic annual income to finance the sea change in infrastructure needed. A stiff tax hike would be combined with the institution of a carbon usage tax. Colleagues of Ocasio-Cortez, those labeled as the radical New Democrats by Fox News, are Rep. Ayanna Pressley, D. Mass., Rep. Rashid Utlaib, D. Mitch, and Rep. Ilhan Omar, D. Min. In addition to supporting the Green New Deal, they all support free college for all, free health care for all, and the abolition of immigration and customs enforcement. While this insurgency of new, young Democrats is the favorite story for stations such as MSNBC and CNN, many of the same ideas within the party were popularized by 77-year-old Senator Bernie Sanders, who those same stations helped to defeat in the 2016 Democratic primaries. The radical New Democrats also identify as a group with Justice Democrats, who favor free maternity care, free child care, expanding anti-discrimination laws, and funding Planned Parenthood. To their credit, Justice Democrats also support ending the war on drugs, pardoning Edward Snowden, reforming the police to ensure accountability, renegotiating trade deals, opposing the World Trade Organization, ending the death penalty, and ending the practice of unilaterally waging war. But defenders of the limitless tax and spend ideologies have never had a realistic grasp of real-world costs to individuals. It is much more difficult and much more expensive to repair an electric car. For example, college instructors have to be paid. Is there a point when regulations or a tax burden on a small business becomes too onerous to keep the doors open and the lights on? How does a small business owner afford a much larger minimum wage? There will be no free program, as every program will have a cost paid by individual taxpayers and small business owners. Every dollar given to someone must be taken from someone else, either voluntarily or by the force of law. The Republicans can be indignant and self-righteously angry at the fire in the belly of the new Democratic representatives, but there should also be a modicum of self-evaluation happening within the GOP. The party has long supported a corrupt war state, a crippling war on drugs, harmful trade policies, and an economic inequity that hurt American workers. These new Democrats are a reaction to a GOP that laughed at Occupy Wall Street rather than taking it seriously, rather than hearing it. The anger didn't end up in front of a video screen after all. It found its way to the nation's capital at a swearing-in ceremony for the new Congress. The GOP is a party deficient of genuine concern for average Americans trying to live a life by classically conservative principles. The American system of capitalism is far from ideal. Donald Jeffries brilliantly wrote about the survival of the richest, a game by which the system has been intentionally rigged to benefit those who were born into it and then stay at the top of the economic ladder. But for even the most admirable staples of the American system to work, there must be a much larger group of givers than there are takers. Though Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged topped out at over 1,100 pages, its message is rather simple. Every giver has a moment when they assess their place in line at the counter of American capitalism. At the point when it becomes more profitable to be in the taker line, that person simply shrugs and steps right over, never to return. If the Green New Deal and the economic platform of the Justice Democrats ever become law, the givers that are expected to fund such initiatives may leave the line en masse, and America as we know it may never return. Trump won't abandon border wall. By Mark Anderson McAllen, Texas. The atmosphere bordered on mayhem in the border city of McAllen, Texas during President Donald Trump's January 10th visit to the Rio Grande Valley, RGV, to inspect the security of the southern border. Close to 1,000 people, sporting banners and placards, lined both sides of South 10th Street just outside Miller International Airport, with about half railing against the proposed completion of the border wall and half expressing strong support for Trump's wall completion proposal. As Air Force One arrived around 12:35 p.m. Central Time, a scuffle or two broke out between the two sides. Although the main steam valve for Trump's detractors and supporters was their messages, this rider approached the demonstrators, whose emotions were piqued by Trump's announced intention to take executive action to finish the wall with or without the backing of Congress. Fox News commentator Geraldo Rivera was nearby, asked whether he's inquiring into specifics on the violence in Central America, since that's what is reportedly prompting migrants to form caravans and head north to begin with. Rivera concurred that's an important question. He then added that the Central American nations, I think, will become even more dysfunctional if something isn't done soon. Signs carried messages ranging from women for Trump and finish the wall, to make America brown again and build bridges not walls. D'Avila of Edinburgh, Texas repeatedly yelled, build that wall, and said that she's a proud Hispanic Trump supporter who feels the wall is needed to reduce the RGV's criminal element. According to Trump supporter Eva Arechiga, that includes drug cartels owning strip joints for hire and young girls who illegally enter the U.S. Miss Avila noted that RGV media often treat Hispanic conservatives like second-class citizens, in trying to uphold a stereotype that all Hispanics want open borders. Miss Arechiga pointed out that the slogan Build Bridges Not Walls seems rather absurd, she said, since there are 15 international bridges between El Paso and Brownsville, which provide plenty of ports of entry for those wanting to enter the U.S. legally and seek asylum. Such misleading slogans and stereotyping by media create a sense of inertia, making it exceedingly difficult to arrive at a solution and stop the border breaches that typically lead to 300-400 apprehensions per day in the RGV sector alone. However, one day after Trump's departure, local news affiliates reported that there were a whopping 700 apprehensions in the RGV sector, a four-county area encompassing Brownsville to the east and Mission to the west, and that's just the number of people illegally entering the U.S. who were caught. Cartel violence. A couple of days before Trump's RGV trip, 21 people were killed, several of whom were lit on fire, in a ghastly shootout that apparently started when a team of gunmen from the Northeast Cartel faction of Los Zetas made an incursion into the nearby Mexican town of Refugio Inosa, currently under the control of the Gulf Cartel. Refugio is a rural community close to Miguel Ayllón and Ciudad Mier, right across the border from Roma, Texas. It's believed that explosives and grenade launchers were used in the skirmish, which torched five vehicles. One of the vehicles left at the scene was a white pickup with Texas license plates and makeshift armored plating. It's important to emphasize that the Roma area, about 50 miles west of where Trump visited the border, lacks border fencing, even though it's a hotbed for drug and human smuggling. It featured Lagos to appear as a vehicle used by the Mexican Navy. The Northeast Cartel has a long history of using cloned uniforms and equipment to blame authorities for their atrocities. Breitbart News noted in a January 10 report, local educator Scott Nicol, who has participated in televised local forums on border issues, does not support the border project. He implied that everyone seeking to enter the U.S. is an innocent asylum seeker with no ill intentions. He told AFP during Trump's RGV visit that walls, in his view, tend to trap migrants and increase their deaths and injuries. He didn't fully clarify why a typical asylum seeker would avoid a legal port of entry where their safety could be better assured and where asylum requests are actually made. Nicol understands that drug traffickers most often use ports of entry to try to smuggle their stuff into the U.S. Therefore, he thinks finishing the border fence won't stop the drug flow much, except for marijuana, which, because it's bulky, is often snuck through unfenced areas rather than hidden in containers at entry ports. However, according to Border Patrol agents, other law enforcement officers, and some local clergy, drug traffickers do traverse unfenced areas well away from ports of entry and not just for moving marijuana. They often do so by piling tires or dense foam across the Rio Grande River, which has many narrow spots and can be shallow enough to walk or cross. Boards are placed atop the tires or the foam so that a vehicle can be driven across the river to move various drugs, other contraband, or people from Mexico to the U.S. Barges are also used to move contraband across the river. Such bleak scenarios backdrop Trump's four-hour visit to the RGV as he divided his time between visiting border locations in the southern McAllen Mission area and conducting a panel discussion with Texas Republican Sens. John Cornyn and Ted Cruz, along with Customs and Border Patrol personnel and Homeland Security officials, despite calls to the Secret Service, a local congressman's office, and the White House press office. This reporter was unable to obtain access to the panel discussion at a McAllen Border Patrol station. Televised excerpts showed Trump clarifying that, when he said Mexico would help pay for the wall, he meant that the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal could provide enough financial benefits for the U.S. that they could be leveraged for wall funding. They say walls are medieval. Well, so is the wheel, he mused. They say I've manufactured this crisis. The only thing that's been manufactured is the word manufactured. In front of him as he spoke was a table displaying drugs and other contraband seized at the border, including a 50-caliber machine gun. Trump's visit seemed to increase his resolve to finish the wall. A few hundred miles of fencing exist now on the 1,900-mile southern border, and construction is already in motion. Well to the west in El Paso, Texas and over to New Mexico, new fencing and wall sections have been under construction for several months, including a $73 million section along a 20-mile stretch in Santa Teresa. NM The El Paso Times reports construction of the president's border wall began, albeit in a piecemeal fashion, as far back as April 2018. Thus, while the showdown over the government shutdown has been contentious, Trump seems two steps ahead of Congress and the malicious mainstream media on this issue, at least in some respects. On November 2, 2018, Customs and Border Protection, CBP, announced in a news release that CBP, in partnership with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, has awarded a contract to construct approximately 6 miles of levee wall system in the U.S. Border Patrol's RGV sector, which was funded in CBP's fiscal year 2018 appropriation. The contract for this project, referred to by CBP as RGV-03, awarded on October 31, 2018 in the amount of $145 million for construction, is scheduled to begin in February 2019. That includes the construction and installation of tactical infrastructure, including a reinforced concrete levee wall to the height of the existing levee, 18 feet, 12 steel bollards installed on top of the concrete wall, and vegetation removal along a 150-foot enforcement zone throughout the approximately 6 miles of the levee wall system. The enforcement zone will also include detection technology, lighting, video surveillance, and an all-weather patrol road parallel to the levee wall. This project lies within the McAllen Station area of responsibility in Hidalgo County. The RGV sector remains an area of high illegal cross-border activity. In 2017, the Border Patrol apprehended over 137,000 illegal aliens and seized approximately 260,000 pounds of marijuana and approximately 1,192 pounds of cocaine. Once constructed, this levee wall system will serve as a persistent impediment to transnational criminal organizations, while still allowing river access for property owners, other federal, state, local officials, local emergency responders and Border Patrol. U.S. birth rates continue free fall. Startling new stats indicate only Hispanics having enough kids to replace population. By Dave Gallery, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Center for Health Statistics, NCHS, revealed last year that American women were having children at the lowest rate recorded since 1987, with just 3.85 million babies born in 2017. Also shocking, women's fertility rate was also the lowest since the U.S. government began tracking it more than 100 years ago. One of the reasons for the drop is the continued sharp decline in teen births, seen as a positive, since children born to adolescents have unfavorable health, behavioral, and educational outcomes throughout their entire lives. The study showed that since 2007, the teen birth rate has declined by 55%, and is down 70% since its peak in 1991. Sustained use of birth control has helped to drive down the teen birth rates. Now, a state-by-state analysis, broken down by ethnicity, by researchers at NCHS, reveals some interesting facts and figures. The analysis uncovered that some areas of the country are much more fertile than others, and that just two states, South Dakota and Utah, have fertility rates that rose to the level needed to sustain the U.S.'s current population, which requires 100 babies to be born for every 1,000 women in order for the country's population to essentially replace itself. Midwest and Southeast states had higher fertility rates than the Northeast or West Coast, where a 57% differential exists between the highest state rate, South Dakota, 2,227 births, and the lowest, the District of Columbia, 1,421 births. According to the study, a January 10 article in the Wall Street Journal reports the total fertility rate, which estimates the number of children a woman would have in her lifetime, was 1,765 births per 1,000 women, far below the replacement level of 100 babies born for every 1,000 women. Also revealed in the analysis is the stark fertility differences between the different races. The only race to exceed the replacement level was Hispanics, who had the highest fertility rate of the ethnicities studied. Blacks achieved that level in 12 states, while whites failed to reach the 2,100 births requirement in any state. It is expected that white people, whose ancestors forged this nation, will experience what it feels like to be a minority soon unless something drastic happens. But the odds are that whites will continue to be displaced and replaced by other ethnic groups, especially Hispanics. The influx of Hispanic immigrants in the first place is thanks to the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, ACA, the Hart-Celler Act, which ended the national origins formula that had been in place since the Emergency Quota Act of 1921. The Hart-Celler Act abolished the quota system based on national origins that had been U.S. immigration policy since the 1920s and began the decades-long discrimination against Northern Europeans. Last time I checked, not a single politician who voted for this bill asked any of their white constituents if they would mind becoming a minority in a few short decades. What we all have allowed our elected representatives to do to our futures is a national disgrace, and we are the ones who have been, and will continue to be, paying the price. Famed activist Red Beckman Dye's IRS critic worked 6 decades teaching fellow patriots their constitutional rights. By Pat Shannon on December 30, 2018, American liberty lovers and truth seekers lost a great friend with the passing of Martin J. Red Beckman. Born in 1928, Beckman had just celebrated his 90th birthday during the recent Thanksgiving week. Since discovering truth, Beckman had spent most of the past half-century writing books, lecturing, producing television videos, and being interviewed on various talk shows. Many of these books he made available to readers of American Free Press through the full-page advertisements he regularly placed in this country's last, real national newspaper. Remembering his military oath taken during the Korean conflict to defend his nation against all enemies, foreign and domestic, it took Beckman a few years after returning home to realize just who these domestic enemies were that were threatening the freedoms of the American people far more than any foreign enemies. Beckman had been introduced to the terrorist tactics of the IRS in 1957 as a contract logger in Montana. He had a good crew and a growing company, and he and his wife, Earlene, were happily raising an expanding family. That is, as he said to this writer, until we were confronted with the most corrupt powers that we hard-working people could ever imagine. Beckman was able to win that first IRS battle and had a brief reprieve until the next confrontation in 1963. He won again that time and had no more problems until 1973-74, when the IRS meddlers next decided to become a problem for the Beckman family. They made a big mistake. He didn't foolishly load his rifle, an act that he knew would be futile, but instead began to fire a different round of bullets, those of information to others. His books have since brought an inspiring message of patriotism to untold thousands of truth seekers, and, we must remember, this was accomplished without benefit of the advertising funds from the giant publishing companies. All the Beckman books were self-published. While that lengthy fight with the IRS was still going on, Beckman authored his first book in 1979. Born Again Republic, a delightful reminder to Americans of the blessed founding of the USA and how the unconstitutional IRS was stealing their wealth and liberties. Known as Montana's Fighting Redhead, the grandfather of FIJA, Fully Informed Jury Association, and America's oldest living patriot, Beckman said only last year that one of his neighbors had just read Born Again Republican and thought it was the best book he had ever read on the subject and that the information therein is more appropriate and applicable today, 40 years later, than it was when he wrote it. Beckman had a great marketing plan. He was more interested in spreading his message than he was in making money with his mission, so whenever he was invited to speak, he came up with an offer no group leader could refuse. Just give us a meal, room for the night and buy a case of books for your own distribution, he would say. Born Again Republic was so well received by American truth seekers that Beckman realized he was harboring more suppressed information and began to write again. A lifelong Christian, he admitted that he was wrong when as a young man he trusted and believed what preachers from the 501(c)(3) corporate churches were teaching, and in 1984 published The Church Deceived, which defines the many lies spread from America's pulpits as gospel truth. Deceived churches are a very serious problem, said Red, because they betray the trust and confidence of the people. The 501(c)(3) tax status, which lured naive church leaders into incorporating as a business, so parishioners could deduct their tithes and offerings, was the brainchild of a criminal U.S. senator from Texas by the name of Lyndon Baines Johnson. Of course, church gifts were already tax-deductible, but Johnson had contrived a plan for eventual control of which messages would be preached from America's pulpits and which would not. Beckman was constantly reminding reading and listening audiences that they had three votes in this nation, and the one on election day might be the least important. The forgotten other two are the grand jury vote, whether or not to indict a fellow citizen, and that from the petty jury box determining the guilt or innocence of a defendant, especially those accused of crimes without a victim. Beckman found it horrifying that Christians were sending Christian brothers and sisters to jail for the alleged crime of not filing papers with the government. In 1990, Beckman followed with Walls in Our Minds, a multi-chapter compilation of essays depicting the many other aspects and methods politicians are using to deceive us daily and the indoctrination process used by the news media to keep us that way. One of the most popular books of all, with an intriguing title, Why the Militia, 1997, commanded the attention of both the pro-constitutionists and those who had been news media brainwashed against the evils of an armed populace. One amusing anecdote surfaced a couple of years later when an IRS-targeted young man appeared in federal court as a pro se defendant against willful failure charges. Following their normal habitude, the IRS had previously released a few derogatory characterizations of John the defendant to the news media, and now in his opening statement, the prosecuting attorney had further attempted to demean the young man by telling the court, among other things, that he was a militia leader. It was an aha moment. Since reading Why the Militia, John had been motivated to brush up on the history of the People's Militia since the 18th century and included his newfound knowledge within his opening statement to sling egg all over the prosecutor's face. First, John told the court about the media smear campaign that had gone on, designed to bias the jurors against him, and then said that the prosecutor had just attempted the same thing by calling me a militia leader. However, the fact is, I have documentary evidence right here, as he waved some handheld papers in the air, that the prosecutor himself is actually a secret member of the People's Unorganized Militia. The 35-year-old assistant U.S. attorney went berserk with a loud objection and screamed that such a thing was a lie. John then motioned that the prosecutor be sworn in and put on the witness stand, but the judge would not allow it. So John began to read from the Militia Act of 1792 that conscripted every free able-bodied white male citizen between the ages of 18 and 45 into a local militia company, which, of course, exposed the ignorance of the prosecutor and entertained the jurors, some of whom suddenly realized that they were militia members as well. Ironically, Beckman's greatest effort became his least appreciated. In 1981, Beckman and a group calling themselves the Montana Historians organized and financed the research and travel of former investigator for the Illinois Department of Revenue Bill Benson to collect the records from all the state capitals in the lower 48 states, which applied to and proved, or disproved, the 1913 lawful passing of the 16th Amendment. The results of that research showed an astounding, documented fact, The amendment purportedly authorizing a tax on personal income had never been lawfully ratified by the states. In fact, it had not even come close. The law that never was became what must be the most censored and government-suppressed book of the 20th century, if not in all the history of the United States. In 1983, before the law that never was published, Beckman was called as an expert witness in a criminal tax trial in Fort Worth, Texas. He presented some of Benson's documents to the court, but the judge not only refused to let the jury see them or hear his testimony but ordered marshals to remove Beckman from the courtroom, thereby displaying more collusion between the courts and the IRS. Following publication, Beckman, Benson, and the Montana Historians funded the delivery of 535 copies to the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C., one to each senator and representative, but never received even a thank you or any sort of acknowledgement from a single congressman. Beckman came close to dying 2 years ago, but with prayer, good nutrition, and the avoidance of medical doctors and Big Pharma, he fought it off more than once. For a while there, he was even talking about writing another book, but the rheumatoid arthritis he had been fighting for a decade or more had recurred to the point that he couldn't even type on the keyboard. The arthritis came and went and came again, and in his last few weeks he was saying, "I don't think God is going to keep me here much longer, and I'm ready to go home." On the last Friday of the year, Earlene reached out to friends and family that she thought the end was near. "He can't walk, and he can't talk," she told me. "I just wanted you to know," and that night I said a little prayer asking for his comfort. After hearing no news on Saturday, I gave Earlene a call on Sunday to see how he was doing. "No change," she said. "He can't get out of bed, and he can't talk." We chatted another minute, and then she put the nurse on to tell me something. "Wanna talk to him, Pat?" I said. "How am I going to talk with him? You just told me he can't talk." "Right," she said, "but he can hear you when I put you on speakerphone. I know he'd like to hear your voice." She walked into the bedroom, and a few seconds later she said, "Go ahead, Pat, he can hear you now." I thought for a moment and told him, "Hey, old pal, you're a tough old coot, but it's okay if you go on up now. We'll see you up there later." Nurse Carey said he showed a slight smile and nodded his head just a little. Only a few hours later they called me back to say, "He just passed away 15 minutes ago." Will of the people being thwarted leftists may not be in Oval Office, but they control schools, colleges, unions, media. By Patrick J. Buchanan. "Those who make peaceful revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable," said John F. Kennedy. In 2016, the U.S. and Britain were both witness to peaceful revolutions. The British voted 52-48 to sever ties to the European Union, restore their full sovereignty, declare independence, and go their own way in the world. Trade and immigration policy would henceforth be decided by a parliament elected by the people, not by bureaucrats in Brussels. Brexit it was called, and British defiance stunned global elites. 2.5 years later, Britain is still inside the EU, and no one seems to know when or whether the divorce will take place, a victory of London and European elites over the expressed will of the British people. Appalled by the Brexit vote, these elites played a waiting game, broadcasting warnings of what could happen, to panic the British public into reconsidering and reversing its democratic decision. Losing candidates and losing parties accept defeat and yield power. Establishments have agendas they do not regard as subject to electoral repudiation or appeal. Defeated, they use their non-electoral powers to prevent unwanted policies from ever being implemented. Call it limited democracy. In 2016, Donald J. Trump was elected president when a spirit of rebellion against America's failed elites roiled both parties. Both the Trump campaign and the Ted Cruz campaign, which ran second in the Republican race, offered anti-establishment ideas. So, too, did the Bernie Sanders campaign in the Democratic primaries. Trump's defining agenda was basically this: he would build a wall across the Mexican border to halt the flood of illegal migrants. He would extricate us from the half-dozen Middle East wars into which Bush II and Obama had plunged us. He would abrogate the trade deals that had seen imports from NAFTA nations, China, the EU, and Japan replace goods made in the U.S., he would halt the shuttering of tens of thousands of U.S. factories and the hemorrhaging of millions of manufacturing jobs. He would call off the new Cold War with Russia, halfway through this presidential term. Where are we? Part of the U.S. government has been shut down for a month. The wall has not been built and may never be. Trump's decision to pull 2,000 U.S. troops out of Syria has met massive resistance from our foreign policy establishment. Trump is being pushed to confront Russia from the Baltic to the Black Sea and to trash the intermediate-range nuclear missile treaty that Ronald Reagan negotiated with Mikhail Gorbachev, and we are being pushed toward a new Mideast war with Iran. This was the establishment's agenda, not Trump's. We have lately learned that after Trump fired FBI Director James Comey, a cabal inside the FBI initiated a counterintelligence investigation to discover if Trump was a conscious agent of a Kremlin conspiracy. Who made this call? Who approved it? Did the FBI discover that Trump is a patriot, or another Algerese? We have not been told by the FBI after 2 years of investigation. Why not? We do know that the dirt-diving arm of the Clinton campaign, Fusion GPS, hired a British former spy with KGB connections to cook up a dirty dossier that was used to persuade the secret Foreign Intelligence Corps to approve the surveillance of the Trump campaign. Yet there seems a massive media disinterest in a conspiracy that might portray Trump as the victim of dirty campaign tricks. Which brings us back to the larger question. While populists have won elections and carried out peaceful revolutions, often the policies for which they have successfully worked are never implemented. In the 1975 book Conservative Votes, Liberal Victories, Why the Right Has Failed, this writer sought to explore and explain the forces that so often deny the right the policy fruits of its political victories. Foremost among these was the new journalism. The essence of press power lies in the authority to select, elevate, and promote one set of ideas, issues, and personalities and to ignore others. This writer wrote, "The press determines what people will talk and think about because of the monopoly it holds over the news and information flowing out of Washington. Among the reasons for Trump's political success, such as it is that today's conservative media did not exist back then, nor did the new social media that he has mastered so well. Yet still, the left's power over America's character and culture-forming institutions remains overwhelming. It dominates public schools and teachers' unions, mainstream churches, college and university faculties, media and entertainment, TV and film. What is taking place in the West today might be described as a struggle between the capital and the country it rules. England voted to leave the EU, London voted to remain. In the last analysis, Kennedy was surely right. People who see the policies they have voted for rejected again and again, by the very elites they defeated, will inevitably turn to other means to preserve what they have. The yellow vest protests in Paris show us that. Deep state targets Corsi over Rashiagut rubbish. By Donald Jeffries. This writer was privileged to interview Jerome Corsi recently on the weekly radio show, I Protest. Corsi has become embroiled in the Rashiagut nonsense, with inferences that he somehow colluded with shadowy Russians and or banished whistleblower Julian Assange. The establishment contends that Corsi obstructed justice by destroying or lying about emails. I'm 72 years old and have never committed a crime, Corsi declared. I don't have as much as a parking ticket to my record. Early on in the interview, Corsi said in regard to his legal issues, I can talk about every single aspect of it. I intend on exposing Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller. I know that they are desperate to put me into prison and shut me up. At another point, he declared, I think my two biggest crimes are that I supported Donald Trump, and I believe in Jesus Christ. Coming from Harvard, that makes me some kind of criminal. Corsi spoke of the two groups of Russians Mueller has indicted, none of whom will be coming to America for trial. They're all just show indictments, said Corsi. He rightly pointed out that most Americans are too dumbed down to know the difference between an indictment and a conviction. Why doesn't Mueller just indict Putin? Corsi asked. Another Russian who's never going to stand trial, Corsi described as grueling the 40 hours, in six sessions, that he spent talking with Mueller. Corsi set out to cooperate to the best of his ability, bringing in his laptops and external hard drive, which had a time machine application. Nothing could be permanently erased, Corsi stated. It was still in the backup system. Corsi gave them his cell phones, usernames, and passwords to his email accounts, anything they wanted. I didn't lie, Corsi maintained. I had memory mistakes. With the way they question you, it's impossible not to have memory mistakes. They have an 8-inch thick book with everything from me in it. They won't let you see it. Regarding the plea deal offered him, Corsi said, I just could not bring myself to swear to God that I committed a crime I didn't commit. The plea deal was hardly lenient anyhow. For a full year, if Corsi said or wrote anything they didn't like, he could be brought back before a judge and get 5 years or whatever in prison. Corsi told them, if that's what America has come to, then take a 72-year-old guy and throw me in prison. I'll die in prison. I'm not going to lie to save my hide, he added. Our government has become the George III that our founding fathers rebelled against, on steroids. If the government is saying something, my first assumption is they were lying. He likened the abusive techniques of American investigators to those of the KGB or Gestapo. The mainstream media has peddled the ridiculous Rashiagat story, which is a twisted foster child of the very real corruption revealed in DNC emails, exposing efforts to undermine the presidential campaign of Bernie Sanders, in order to benefit deep state favorite Hillary Clinton. There was the corresponding murder of young DNC staffer Seth Rich, whom Assange all but named as the leaker of the emails involved. Corsi is determined to fight the absurd allegations, declaring that the cause of freedom has been paid for with the lives and blood of a lot of patriots. Corsi said he authorized Mueller and his team to get his phone records. Mueller doesn't have a crime, he said. They have invented a crime, collusion with Russia. The real reason for the show trial, said Corsi, was that Mueller was out to get Donald Trump indicted or impeached from the beginning and was only looking for evidence to fit his predetermined conclusion that the president is a criminal. Corsi is not some predictable right-wing zealot. He went to Harvard and wrote his dissertation on the right of the New York Times and the Washington Post to publish the Pentagon Papers. The lengthy report that was leaked by Daniel Ellsberg to the media and showed how the U.S. had engaged in a secret war in Vietnam and Cambodia unbeknownst to the American people. Full disclosure, Corsi has written blurbs for all of this writer's books, including Survival of the Richest, How the Corruption of the Marketplace and the Disparity of Wealth Created the Greatest Conspiracy of All. Not exactly standard conservative reading. The idea that Corsi, or Roger Stone, or Steve Bannon, or Paul Manafort, or Donald Trump himself, colluded with Russia to deny Hillary Clinton the presidency ought to be scoffed at by even the most gullible members of the public. America has a long history of voting fraud, from landslide Lyndon Johnson and his dead demographic base to the widespread corruption exposed in the Collier Brothers' book Vitescam. The Russians had nothing to do with any of that. Corsi's legal case demonstrates that legal and political persecution are alive and well in this country. Have you gotten a new copy of Deep Truth Journal? Deep Truth Journal, DTJ, is the magazine that will make the state sponsor talking heads, court historians, and textbook conglomerates rethink what they've done throughout their comfortable careers. It's the journal that is set to blow the lid off the historical establishment by challenging it with facts, eyewitness testimony, and biting commentary in an effort to offer an alternative to the status quo. Don't let the cozy academics define truth for you. Go deeper and get history resolved with Deep Truth Journal. In this 132-page inaugural issue of DTJ, we have gathered together some of the most respected historical and political researchers ever assembled in one publication. James DiEugenio's feature on JFK, Dan Hammarskjöld, and Patrice Lumumba examines the crises and deaths of three men out to change the future of Africa. Deep state actors didn't want the Congo to be truly independent, as the theft of its mineral wealth was enriching colonial powers who didn't want to see the contents of this treasure chest going to the people of the Congo. Were they all assassinated to protect deep state profits? DiEugenio reveals the truth. William Davy profiles Jim Garrison, who in 1969 prosecuted the only trial attempting to resolve the murder of President Kennedy. Find out how Garrison's investigation unfolded and who he believed was deeply involved in the assassination of JFK. Malcolm X was assassinated in 1965. but were deep state actors involved. Renowned African-American journalist and author Carl Evans delves into the intelligence community's involvement in the murder of Malcolm X and how his timely death solved a serious problem for the deep state. Researcher Douglas Horn details FDR's plan to lure the Japanese to Pearl Harbor, incorporating new research on this day of infamy and death. Political conspiracy expert Jim Haugen looks deeper into the identity of Watergate's deep throat, while Lisa Pease exposes the CIA's nefarious connections to the mainstream media and why this is such a problem for American democracy today. In Why the State Hates Conspiracy, respected investigator Joseph Green questions why the media covers the stories it does while ignoring important topics much more vital to our futures. Our inaugural edition of DTJ also includes John Podesh on the sabotage of the candidacies of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump by the deep state, Donald Jeffers's critical view of Abraham Lincoln and his policed state, St. Patrick's look at the censoring of college professors and the state of free speech at institutions of higher learning today, also included her columns by Richard Bartholomew and Randolph Benson, as well as features on the mysterious murder of Seth Rich and the myths of American history that still cloud our understanding of the past. Currently, DTJ is scheduled for 2 issues per year, but your enthusiasm for this kind of previously censored information can make the difference. Support DTJ's efforts by buying a copy for yourself and additional copies for friends and family. Purchase copies for libraries and universities. Help us break through the blockade on the truth. Copies of DTJ are $15 each. Please include $4 S&H per copy for addresses inside the U.S. Outside the U.S. you must add $25 S&H for 1 copy. AFP is handling DTJ's fulfillment, so call them toll-free at 1-888-699-6397 to charge or send an order to AFP, 16,000 Trade Zone Avenue, Unit 406, Upper Marlboro, Doctor of Medicine 20774. Email the editorial staff with comments at deeptruthjournal@gmail.com.